How do I get into Met Gala?
You are Locked On Fantasy Basketball, your daily podcast on fantasy basketball. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Hello and welcome to the Locked On Fantasy Basketball podcast brought to you by Basketball Monster. My name is Josh Lloyd and I am the lead fantasy analyst at basketballmonster.com, and you can find me on Twitter as always at redrock_Beeble. The second round of the playoffs is coming to a close fairly quickly, so that means two game nights are pretty much done, and today is in terms of looking at what's happening for Wednesday, there's only one game on Wednesday, so the DFS stuff is probably going to be done for the season now, but that doesn't mean the podcasts That doesn't mean the podcasts stop coming. There's still plenty of information, coach stuff, free agency, draft recaps, draft previews, lots of different stuff happening all throughout the rest of the postseason and the offseason, heading into the preseason, of course. We're going to be covering a couple of those things in today's podcast. We're going to be continuing our 2017 draft recap with picks 13 through 16. That's Donovan Mitchell, Bam Adebayo, Justin Jackson, and Justin Patton of the Minnesota Timberwolves. We're also going to be talking about the Detroit Pistons coaching situation and the Charlotte Hornets coaching situation. So, Michael Bolton,
let's get to it.
Let's get to it indeed. If you aren't aware, which I'm sure you are, that Stan Van Gundy is out in Detroit, both as GM and as coach. Stan did come out and say that he was willing to give up all of his GM powers and remain the coach, but the Pistons decided that wasn't the way they wanted to go, so he is out in Detroit. Matt from Locked On Pistons has a reaction to that. You can check out his full podcast on that over on Locked On Pistons, but I'm going to play a quick excerpt from that podcast now from Matt from Locked On Pistons talking about the Stan Van Gundy firing in Detroit.
Hey, this is Matt Shook of Locked On Pistons. But after a month, it finally happened. Stan Van Gundy was fired Monday by the Pistons as coach and president of basketball operations, with a rather strange press release by the team where Tom Gores, the owner, and Stan Van Gundy, he said, Tom Gores, that Stan wanted to return. Quote, "Stan is a competitor and he wanted to finish the job," Gores said. Not quite sure exactly why Gores needs to be pointing that out. I don't know if that's a dig at Stan Van Gundy or if that's trying to make him look better. It was a strange way of putting that. After 4 years, with 1 year remaining on his contract, Stan will not be coming back. Van Gundy's 4 years featured a rapid ascent to the playoffs in year two after taking over a franchise stuck in the mud, but the last two were obviously disappointing seasons, hindered by reckless free agent misses and draft night head scratchers, most notably taking Luke Kennard over Donovan Mitchell last summer, as Mitchell began to, it looks like a starring career that he's going to have with the Utah Jazz. And that one spelled the end of the Stan Van Gundy era. We may never know what happened in the days of California meetings between Gores and Van Gundy that dragged out recently. And why did they drag out so long is the biggest question probably on Pistons fans right now on the minds. But Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN reported that last week that Gores wanted Stan Van Gundy to stay on as coach but retool the front office structure. But they weren't able to reach that agreement, nor were they able to get into any extension that Stan Van Gundy was likely pining for with only 1 year left in his deal. So Dan will collect $7 million and probably have his pick of television jobs, as he's a engaging and compelling personality in front of the microphones. All told, it'll probably be better for him than a lame duck year under a new boss that didn't hire him. So the Pistons joined the coach and executive searches nearly a month after their season ended. Again, why did that take so long? Names like Steve Clifford, Mike Budenholzer, or former Piston Jerry Stackhouse figure to be tossed around in terms of coaching candidates, although this job certainly ranks below division rival Milwaukee in the pecking order of openings. And you can draw your own conclusions as fans and coaches out there about where the Pistons fall in terms of some of these other ones, like the Charlottes or maybe the rebuilding teams such as Atlanta that still have openings as well. Woj of ESPN also reported that former Arne Tellen client Brent Berry could be involved in the new front office as well. Former Pistons star Chauncey Billups was also attached to the team's front office in a report from Mark Stein of the New York Times earlier this year in January as potentially part of the revamped front office for the Pistons and his former team. The team will move forward with a potentially awkward and injury-prone core of Blake Griffin, Reggie Jackson, and Andre Drummond with little salary cap flexibility and almost assuredly no first-round pick next month. But if there's one thing we can guess about Gores, a Malibu resident who has gravitated more to his glitzy life in California than his Michigan background, it's that he's probably going to want to make a splash. Based on his bidding of Van Gundy away from the Warriors 4 years ago and his at least approval of the Griffin trade this year, he'll be hoping to make that big splash and get the Pistons out there and in a winning position, and especially in the newspapers and on Twitter right away, and hopefully back in the playoffs as quickly as this year. And we will see how that works out for the Detroit Pistons down the road, again, who have fired Stan Van Gundy as coach and president of basketball operations. This is Matt Shook for Locked On Pistons. Thanks for listening.
All right, so that's Matt from Locked On Pistons discussing the whole Van Gundy situation. All of the usual names are going to be in contention there, as we heard. You know, Budenholzer, Stackhouse, there's going to be many different guys there. So hard to judge exactly what's going to happen in terms of the impact on it for fantasy next season. The one thing that I would think that the team would go for, not sure about this, that they will go with a coach who maybe is a little bit more accommodating to younger players. Doesn't sit them just because they're rookies, as Van Gundy did to Henry Ellenson last year, who barely saw the court, even though Ellenson has sucked pretty much the majority of his career. Luke Kennard this season, who was obviously limited by the Van Gundy rookiness, even though he did start to play a little bit down the stretch, but to me that was too little too late. And Van Gundy's GM decisions obviously made some pretty poor choices there. Langston Galloway, the tackle box, John Lua, as some notable poor decisions there from Stan in the front office. The Blake Griffin trade is not something that's necessarily all Van Gundy's fault. The owner, as we heard Matt said, was definitely on board with that. So we'll see how that all pans out in the future. But he did some good things. Getting Tobias Harris was an excellent trade. So he did well in the trade market. Just some of the other stuff didn't necessarily go his way. But we'll obviously have updates as the coach gets hired and the new GM gets hired there in Detroit. We do have news of the Charlotte Hornets signing their new head coach. We'll talk about that a little bit later on in the show. But now let's go to a player who's already been referenced in that Locked On Pistons drop, Donovan Mitchell, the 13th pick in the 2017 NBA draft. Many people speculating that the reason that Van Gundy was fired is because he chose Kennard over Don Mitchell. And let's be honest, nobody thought Mitchell was going to be this level of superstar that he currently is. If you thought that, then I don't know what to tell you. Now, I know that the Utah Jazz people were extremely, extremely impressed with him. We've heard it numerous times. I've heard it from David Locke himself, who was there for the workout, and they said, as soon as the workout finished, if any of you mention anything about this workout, you are immediately fired. That's how closely guarded they wanted that information, that they were going to trade up to get Mitchell. So I guess they were convinced, but so many other teams did pass on Mitchell. And you could obviously, in hindsight, picking Kennard over Mitchell looks poor, but no one expected Don to ascend to this level as quickly as he has. But that does bring us into talking about Donovan Mitchell and talking about just how excellent he was during his first season in the NBA. Absolutely stunning stuff from Mitchell. He played 79 games for the year, regular season, 33 minutes per game, averaged over 20 points per game, which is astonishing. 20.5 points, 2.5 triples, 3.7 rebounds and 3.7 assists, 1.5 steals on 44, 81 and 34% from three. Now that brings him a little bit below league average in terms of true shooting percentage. He was at 54% there on a usage of 29, but for a rookie, that is absolutely astonishing. He finished the season as the 47th ranked player overall, and it feels like it is just scratching the surface. He hasn't yet turned 22. He is not far off that, a couple of months away from that. So he's on the older side for a rookie. We're talking about a guy who's a year and a half older than Jason Tatum, over a year older than Lonzo Ball, over a year older than John Isaac and De'Aaron Fox. So he is that little bit more experienced just in terms of life years, but obviously in NBA basketball, he's played the same amount of time, and he was one of the most electrifying rookies we have seen in recent memory. We have a look at some of his fantasy ranks for the year. You see, he started off slowly because he started off the season shooting poorly. And for the first couple of weeks, he was down in the 300s, 250s. But then he started his climb up, and basically for or from your middle of December onwards, he was a top 50 player consistently for the rest of the year after that really, really slow start that was hampered by some really poor shooting that was a significant detriment to your team's field goal percentage. And again, one of the reasons why I do like punting field goal percentage is you can get so many other things in there if you're just not caring about that category, which does have significant impact because it's one of those categories that can actually go into the negative as opposed to others where their floor level, say, if you don't hit threes, you can't get it taken away from you. The lowest you can get is to zero. But if your field goal percentage is bad on large attempts, you actually become a real negative in that area rather than just an absolute baseline. And that's, you know, one of those reasons why punting percentages can be the most impactful way to go about it. If you look at his 2 week rolling averages, you see there, you know, he got up. He was a top 50 player through that middle of November area after starting off so poorly. And then you see him jump up to have a real stretch here through the start of December where he was about a top 25, top 30 player for, you know, 4 to 5 weeks at a time. Had a little bit of a down patch towards the end of January, middle of February, where some of his shooting did drop, but finished off really strongly to finish as that guy who was always hovering around the top 50, which I don't think anyone is too surprised about when we see especially if you own him, if you knew what he did this year. Now, he has just been eliminated from the playoffs as the Jazz lost to the Rockets in Game 5, and he left that game with a knee injury. We don't have any information on it just at this point. It was a contact injury, so not a non-contact, not a sprain type thing. He banged knees with Harden and had to be carried off, or not helped off the court, maybe not carried. So hopefully there's nothing severe there. I guess worst case scenario you're thinking is a potential crack in the patella, maybe ligamentous damage, but I really doubt that. But don't think there's anything too concerning to worry about. He is getting x-rays on that knee, and if while I'm recording, information might come through. We'll see. I'll keep an eye on that if I can update you on that later on about his injury. But I don't think it's anything to be too overly concerned about. One thing that Mitchell did do this season, and he started to take on more point guard role down the end, especially in the playoffs with Ricky Rubio out, he started averaging more assists, getting to 4.5, 5 assists per game, playing as that point guard. Now, Rubio has got probably at least one more season in Utah, meaning Mitchell probably plays off the ball, but I can see in time that they'll just push him to be a point guard. And I think in terms of us looking at his long-term fantasy future, that the Don is probably looking at being a top 10 ceiling. He's a guy that we can look at as a 25-point-per-game scorer, a 4.5-rebound, a 5 to 5.5 assists player, perhaps. Yeah, how does he go with getting steals? He was at 1.5 this season. Yeah, that's obviously excellent. That can push up to maybe 1.7, and he just needs to get that efficiency up. Now, as I said, his efficiency did drop in the playoffs quite a bit. He was shooting under 40% for big stretches of time there, under 30% from three on significantly large usage of over 30% in the playoffs. And that was an issue, but he still put up those really, really big numbers, and I don't think it's too much to be concerned about, but there's no reason to me that he can't become a 45 or 46% field goal percentage guy or a 37 to 38% three-point guy. The free throws are obviously excellent. He still can improve by getting to the line more. Averaged almost 4 attempts per game this season. That could easily push to 5 or 5.5 because we know that he has no concern about going to the rim, and he finishes at the rim exceptionally well, so a couple more free throws could be coming his way. And when you're shooting 82% or the 90%+ he was shooting in the playoffs, that is a tremendous value for us when we're talking about fantasy value. Now, I just got the news come through on Donovan Mitchell's injury. It's nothing to be concerned about. He says he's got a left foot soreness with x-rays negative. So nothing too worrisome there. It did look like his knee. The Jazz have been quite coy with injuries throughout their history. We remember all the Derek Favors stuff when he had that bad back, from sleeping on a mattress. So we'll wait and see what happens over the coming days, but they're calling the injury left foot soreness. So I don't think it's any real concern long-term as we move forward for the Don. In terms of his advanced numbers, yeah, excellent stuff, really. Yeah, big positive VORP, strong PR. As I said, the true shooting a little bit below average. Win shares were good. His win shares per 48 a little bit below 0.1. Some of that's team related. And he still had some issues with efficiency stuff, as I've talked about. But an almost zero defensive box score plus minus is great for a rookie guard. He was a plus 6.9
giggity
for his on-off, which is, again, excellent as a rookie on a team that's as deep and as consistent as what the Jazz were. That's really impressive to see that from Mitchell. It's really hard to fault too much about him apart from the field goal percentage. If we have a look at some of the stuff he did, you know, as per the clean the glass numbers, he was in the 90th percentile in terms of usage as a combo guard as a rookie, which is a phenomenal number. His assist to usage percentage was really, really low, though. That's something that they tracked then. He was in the 9th percentile there. So obviously the assist numbers as opposed to the usage rate, really lacking there. But as I said, I think he can transition into more of a ball handler as his career moves forward. His assist rate wasn't fantastic. He still got a decent chunk of his shots assisted in the 75th percentile there. So still not, yeah, in the upper echelon or the elite areas of self-creation. Can get better there. But his shot selection was fine. He hit his shots at a good rate. Now, one thing that I think we do have to have maybe a level of care with is the fact that his long mid-range shots, he hit them at 41%. Now, he was up and down with his shooting, but that's a decently high number. And there is level for regression there. And if that comes down, not that he takes a big amount of shots from there, but if that does start to come down, then that is something that might impact his field goal percentage in a negative way. He was a solid finisher at the rim. We saw all those, you know, crazy shots that he was hitting, scoop layups and under reverse layups, just crazy stuff that he was doing. We saw his dunks, we saw his putbacks. We know how good that this guy can be. He also had a really high steal rate, a pretty solid block rate for a guard as well. Drew fouls at a solid enough rate, but still has a big level of improvement there that can come, which really does show you that ceiling that he can get to. As I said, top 10 is probably his ceiling that he gets to as a 25, 4, and 5 player with potentially 1.7 steals and almost 3 triples. I reckon that's probably where he gets to. And then the efficiency is going to be the last deciding factor when we talk about the Don and his overall fantasy value. Now, another coaching hire has been completed. Spurs assistant James Borrego has been signed to be the head coach of the Charlotte Hornets. The guys at Locked On Hornets have got their thoughts on the signing, and then we'll get back and talk about that. Well, I'll get back and talk about that after we hear what the guys at Locked On Hornets have to say about the Borrego hire.
I'm Walker Mail of the Locked On Hornets podcast. The Charlotte Hornets now have selected James Borrego as their new head coach. Again, this is coming after the Hornets had finalized a couple of head coaching candidates in the Spurs assistant James Borrego and the Celtics assistant Jay Larinaga. Again, Adrian Wojnarowski just reporting that James Borrego would be the new head coach for the Charlotte Hornets. Now, Borrego comes in having had 10 years of experience under Greg Popovich, did serve a short stint with the Orlando Magic under Jacques Vaughn, eventually taking over for him when he was let go by the Magic, and accumulating a 10-20 record as the interim head coach. Of course, Scott Skiles comes in with Orlando to become the new head coach, and Borrego goes back to the San Antonio Spurs to serve under Greg Popovich. Also served under Monty Williams for a brief stint with the New Orleans then Hornets. Monty Williams, of course, coming also from that Greg Popovich tree. So James Borrego has a little bit of head coaching experience as the interim head coach with Orlando, but also a ton of experience under what a lot of people consider to be the best coach in today's NBA and maybe of all time, and Greg Popovich. So Borrego now replaces Steve Clifford, who was fired at the end of this regular season, as Mitch Kupchak, the new general manager of the Charlotte Hornets, came in and decided Steve Clifford's fate. Mitch Kupchak, again, served a long time with the Los Angeles Lakers, about 20 years, and he is at the helm now of the Charlotte Hornets' decision-making as the general manager who now brings in James Borrego. A couple of other questions to go on with the Charlotte Hornets as what their future may look like. You do have Kemba Walker, who was rumored in some trade consideration really before the trade deadline. They held on to him then. It does not mean that he is a surefire thing to stay on this Charlotte Hornets roster, so who knows what Mitch Kupchak decides to do there. You do have, of course, Dwight Howard, who is a guy that is a big man down low that is kind of losing some value in today's NBA, but still carries a hefty contract. You wonder what kind of trading partners the Charlotte Hornets could see there. There's a lot of questions for the Charlotte Hornets team, but one that is no longer a question, they did find the answer, at least of now, and that is James Borrego, the San Antonio Spurs former assistant, now the Charlotte Hornets' new head coach. Again, thanks for listening. I'm Walker Mayle on the Locked On Hornets podcast.
As Walker said, Borrego was the interim coach in Orlando when Jacques Vaughn was fired. I didn't think that he did anything completely inspiring, really, at all. Very similar to J.B. Bickerstaff's tenure in Houston and in Memphis. He was fine, but he wasn't really in serious consideration for that position. And then they brought in Scott Skiles. It feels quite underwhelming. Will this change much about what the Hornets do? I don't see Borrego as coming in as having some huge impact on what the Hornets do. Their roster's pretty much set as it is. Not all that flexible. Dwight Howard, Kemba Walker, trades could be made. Kupchak might be doing that. I'm not certain that's going to be the case. I just don't think there's going to be a huge impact on Borrego coming in. He doesn't strike me as someone who's going to be changing things up, significantly. The one thing I think we do need to look at is what this means for a guy like Malik Monk, with Michael Kidd-Gilchrist being ineffective this season and seeing his minutes tumble with Marvin Williams another year older. Does MKG move to the four? Does Monk move into the starting lineup and Batum move over to the three? How does he view Jeremy Lamb? They are the big question marks, I think, with Charlotte. And we saw Monk really start to take over at the end of the season, and that could be something that Borrego is really interested in developing. Whereas Clifford was obviously unnecessarily harsh on the playing time that was dealt out to Malik. So that'll be interesting to see. That's probably the one big thing I want to look at, how he deploys the Howard-Zeller rotation. Not that I think that much will change there. It's more going to be what happens with Kidd-Gilchrist, Marvin, and then Jeremy Lamb and Malik Monk that are the big question marks there in Charlotte. But we'll see how that all that pans out over time and with free agency and all those sort of moves that still need to go down. Let's move on now to the next player from that NBA draft, and that is Bam Adebayo of the Miami Heat. He was the last selection in the lottery. The Heat picked him with the 14th pick. And I think it's safe to say that Adebayo exceeded expectations during the year. I thought it was an okay pick at the time. I didn't think it was a great one. Adebayo had limitations with what he did at Kentucky, but so many times the players coming out of Kentucky, and it's going to be something that's really important for us to look at with these Kentucky players coming to this year's draft, they show way more in the NBA than what they do at Kentucky, just because of the players that are around them there, or the system that Calipari runs that limits them fully exploring all of their skills. Devin Booker was one of those. Karl Anthony Towns was one of those. There's someone else in my head that I've completely forgotten. The Blue Arrow, Jamal Murray. Guys playing out of position, not doing what they're fully capable of doing. And that gives us somewhat of a skewed view of them coming into the league. Now, if we look at what Bam did for the season, he had his moments. He ended the year as the 247th ranked player in just under 20 minutes per game. 7 points, 5.5 rebounds, half a steal, 0.6 blocks, 51% and 72% for a true shooting of 57%. The assists, 1.5 in 20 minutes, not actually a bad number. So that was one of those things that he showed more ability to do in the pros than he did at Kentucky. A good steal rate, a pretty good block rate as well in just those 20 minutes per game. But he was obviously limited by the other players on that team. Hassan Whiteside's their starting center. They brought Kelly Olynyk in. They were playing Jimmy Johnson as a center at times. We've seen in the past Eric Spoelstra go to Justice Winslow at center lineup. So that does limit what Bam can do. And he had really topsy-turvy playing time. Didn't play much at the start. That's not true. Didn't play much in the first couple of games. Came in for three big starts and played well. Disappeared from the rotation again. Came back into the rotation in December and put up some numbers. And then when everyone was healthy, when Whiteside and Olynyk were back later on in the year, the minutes faded and his production faded as well. Let's have a look at his two-week rolling average over here. Yeah, you can see there's really some solid peaks a couple of times here. Start of December where he was a top 50 player and a top 100 player for 3-4 weeks at a time. In February, he jumped up to be a top 100, top 70 sort of guy. And towards the end of the year, started to climb back into the top 200s. But so much up and downness with his overall production. If we have a look at how that rank looks throughout the whole season, you can see that, a real nice rise there in December when the players were injured like Whiteside and Olynyk. and kept himself steady around that 200 mark, and then a little bit of a tail off towards the end of the year. But of course, we saw the limitations of Hassan Whiteside in the playoffs. He is due two more years at a significantly large rate, I think $52 million. Whiteside is still due, so trading him is going to be tough. Will Spoelstra bench him in favor of Adebayo? I think for next season, that's probably a little bit unlikely, especially when Kalilinic is their best center and played, you know, the best for this team down the stretch in the playoffs. So Bam is still a part of this roster crunch at the center position, but I imagine that he's got a chance to at least play more than the 20 minutes per game he played this season, with Whiteside maybe losing an extra 1 or 2 minutes, or maybe even more as Bam does start to step forward. How do we look at his ceiling? I think it's limited just because of, he doesn't shoot threes. He's not going to be a 20, 25 point per game sort of a guy. He's not going to be a 3 block per game sort of a player, but he's a relatively efficient free throw shooter. He's already efficient as a rookie coming in terms of his finishing. He showed increased passing chops that we hadn't really expected. And he had a run there in the middle of March of four games of 3-3-2 and 3 assists when he played at least 24 minutes in those starts. So that's obviously encouraging. A couple of 6 and 5 assist games. He did have a 5 block game back in January against the Raptors, where he went 16 and 15 with those 5 blocks and 3 assists. So, showing some of those peaks and some of the things that he can do gives us faith in him developing into a good player. I think it's probably going to come more in 19-20, maybe 2021. But if he is the starting center next season, I wouldn't be completely stunned, but I would be a little bit surprised. But I imagine an extra couple of minutes come onto Adebayo's total. But we also have to remember that some of his minutes this season were inflated by injuries to both Whiteside and Olynyk that enabled him to get that extra playing time. In terms of advanced numbers, good true shooting, really good win share numbers, really strong defensive box score plus minus, a positive box score plus minus, an above average PER, as I said, really strong win shares stuff. All that is pointing to a productive player in the future, a winning type of player. And as a rookie big man, a negative 0.9 on off is fairly, it's a fairly positive thing when you're playing with Whiteside and Olynyk there as well. Established players, even though Whiteside had his struggles, he still can be a good player. So that is a huge, huge positive thing for Bam to be able to do that, to be efficient, to be contributing defensively, to be not a horrendous option when on the court. In fact, quite a good one. All those things do really work in Adebayo's future. Basically, all of his shots came at the rim this season, 73% of his shots at the rim, and he didn't finish them at a high rate, just 63%, which as a big is in the 32nd percentile according to Clean the Glass. So he does need to improve his finishing, which is something that will come. I'm pretty confident with that. He didn't take any threes. He's not at that spot yet. If he developed a three-pointer at some point, 5 to 6 years down the track, I wouldn't be stunned. I think that could be something that happened. He was quite adept at drawing fouls, which is strong, but he does need to work on some of the other defensive stuff in terms of defensive stats. Block rate and steal rate needs some work. Just 1.7% block rate, 1.1% steal rate, which is right in the middle of where big men sit, which is okay as a rookie, but he didn't completely stand out in that area. But he can still push forward a little bit. I think those things, as well as maybe the potentially limited offensive game from a scoring point of view, keeps him from ever being a top 30 guy consistently. We saw him have peaks of top 50 production this season. We've seen that already, coming on the back of some high assist and high block games. But can he do that consistently? I think we're looking at a bloke, again, and this draft class is just ridiculously stacked. I think we're looking at a guy who can be a 26-minute-a-night center in the next 3 seasons, can be a top 90 player relatively consistently. But it's not going to happen, I don't believe, straight away. Again, so much can change in the offseason, and we'll revisit this when we get into things in August and September. But still a fair way to go. Per 36 numbers is often an interesting thing to look at with rookies. 12 and 10 with 2.5 assists, 0.8 steals, and 1.1 blocks. It is obviously showing there is room for improvement, especially in those defensive numbers for Bam Adebayo. But overall, I would say that he exceeded exceeded my expectations for the season, which is always a good thing, not necessarily my expectations, but exceeding expectations in general, showing flashes of things you didn't know that he had, and showing that you could go, you know what, I feel like I can be comfortable saying that this guy can be a starter in the future, is a really positive thing for Miami and for Bam, especially if they do need to unload some of these contracts, whether that is Whiteside or whether that is Olynyk, who's still due 3 more years and I think 30s in millions. I don't have the number in front of me. It's pretty high, but there's 3 more years left on Kelly Olynyk's contract. Now, the next two players I'm going to talk about, I'm not going to be quite as positive as I was with the Don and with Bam. We go to pick 15, and that's the Sacramento Kings. They obviously had pick 10. They traded back for pick 15 and 20, which it could end up being a poor decision given just how many rookies they did have on their team already. They had that opportunity to draft a player like a Malik Monk, like a Don Mitchell, like a Kennard, like an Adebayo, but they traded back. And they picked with the first one of their selections, Justin Jackson, who, I don't know, he played minutes this season. We know that he played some minutes, but was he actually good in them? He played 22 minutes in 68 games this year, which on this team, yeah, that's fine. He started a chunk of games as well, but averaged 6.7 points, under 3 rebounds, 0.8 threes, 1 assist, 0.4 steals, 0.2 blocks, 44, 72, and 31 for a true shooting of 52%. There is nothing looking at that where I go, yeah, they're good numbers, or they're great numbers, or there's something I'm looking at there. In fact, if we have a look at his per 36 numbers, he was the 452nd ranked player in per 36 value for the season, which is obviously horrible. For the year overall, he was 329th with those numbers I mentioned, but per 36, 11 points with 1.5 threes, under 2 assists, 0.7 steals, 0.3 blocks, no defensive numbers to really speak of at all, poor percentages, poor assist numbers. I don't know. He's a guy that's, he's already turned 23, so we're not talking about a younger player at this point. He's still got some development to come with him, but to me, he is not a long-term starter. In the NBA, he could be an interesting eighth man type of player, ninth man type of player. He showed a couple of flashes. In fact, he had a couple of strong games towards the end of the year against Phoenix and Memphis, but of course, it was against Phoenix and Memphis, two teams who were trying their darndest to lose. He played 42 minutes against the Suns on the 3rd of April and had 19, 8, and 4 with a steal and a block. I think he actually might have won Monstrous Line of the Night on that day. And then against the Grizzlies 3 days later, he played 30 minutes and had 13, 2, and 2 with 3 triples, shooting at least 50% in both of those games and 50% from 3 in both of those games. So strong performances. He also had a 20-pointer against the Hawks on the 22nd of March. Again, common denominator, a team that is trying to lose. And he put up big numbers in scoring-wise on 7 of 8 shooting, but did nothing else there. And really, the highlights from Justin Jackson, outside of a couple of big games in November where he had 16 and 19 points, and to be fair to him, and to be honest, they were against the Thunder and against the Sixers. So good performances against those teams, but he just does not contribute outside of when he has a hot shooting night. The scoring goes up, but he just doesn't do anything in any of these other areas. And that, to me, is a real, real concern when we're looking at his overall value. Now, we don't know what pick the Kings are going to have in this draft this year. Next season, they don't have their draft pick at all. Could they find a wing that replaces him? It really depends, I guess, what their selection is or who they're looking for, but I don't see Jackson as any player that you should be considering as part of a core of a starting five, of a best four player on a decent team, not even necessarily a playoff team, on a 9 or 10 set. I don't see him as being that guy, and this might seem like I'm being overly harsh on Jackson, but for as good as this rookie class has been, and I've spoken, glowingly about nearly all these guys, Lonzo and Markel and Tatum and Foxy and Isaac and Joshy Jackson and Zachy Collins and Luke Kennard, guys who did struggle a bit this season, Malik Monk with his big performance at the end of the year. I just don't see Jackson like that really at all, and I do have my concerns. He had a PR of 9, a true shooting of 52, a putrid box score plus minus and win shares, defensive box score plus minus, He was on off. That's a positive for him as a negative 0.5. But remember, the players also playing those positions was 41-year-old Vince Carter. We had Garrett Temple and we had fellow rookie Bogdan Bogdanovic. So it's not like he was, compared to excellent players in that sort of a situation that would cause his number to, I don't know. Look, he was okay. In the on-off number. It's nothing absolutely spectacular from him, but it is something where you can maybe cling a little bit of hope to him saying, well, at least he didn't completely shit the bed. But again, he's still nothing's looking superb when I look at his numbers for the season. Really low usage, under 13% according to Clean the Glass, poor assist percentage. I don't know. Just, shot selection was pretty good. I'll give him that. Yeah, he took a decent amount of his shots from three, 42% of his shots from deep. Didn't hit them all that well, 32%, as we've talked about. But one thing, I'll give him credit for this. He finished at the rim at an excellent rate, 77% finishing. The problem is he went there so very seldom because he just doesn't have the moves off the dribble. He's not that attacking the rim sort of guy. He only shot 21% of his shots at the rim. And again, finish them at such a high rate. His mid-range shooting was actually really, really good, which is another reason why, despite having such a low field goal percentage, yeah, there's still room for regression there. He was in the 84th percentile on his short mid-range shots. In fact, in all of his mid-range shots, he was 90th percentile, hitting 45% of his mid-ranges. That is a scary number because that could be, look, maybe he is this excellent mid-range shooter, but maybe he's not. And that's got a chance to drop there as well. The rim finishing, again, is an impressive number. Putrid block and steal rates, 20th percentile in steals, 16th percentile in block numbers, and nothing about him playing in college or for me watching him makes me think he's ever going to be some sort of defensively, statistically impactful guy there for our purposes. Personally, I'd be pretty stunned if Justin Jackson ever became a top 100 player. I'd probably, if we're going to be honest with it, be stunned if he ever became a top 200 player, if he ever had one season inside the top 200. And again, it does feel like I'm being pretty harsh on him, but I've got to try and, not everyone's going to be great from this rookie class. I think there's a lot of guys with potential. I don't think that he is one of them. And I don't know. I just wasn't overly impressed with what I saw on a team that was bereft of talent and opportunity was given to him consistently. He just did nothing with it. He couldn't hit his shots. And maybe some of that is to do with poor teammates, not getting open looks and not being in those positions or being guided to positions by other players who actually know what they're doing half the time. But yeah, nothing overly positive from Justin Jackson this season, apart from the fact that he played over 20 minutes a game, he started a chunk of games, and he had a couple of decent breakout-ish type of performances. We have a look at his two-week rolling average. You see a nice little bump there around the All-Star break where he did, for a small stretch of time, challenge the top 100. He did the same thing towards the end of March as well, but majority of the time he was in that 250 to 200 range, going up and down. Towards the end of the year, March onwards, maybe I'm being a little bit harsh on him saying that I don't think he can ever become a top 200 guy for a season, but that's mainly based on the fact that I just don't think he can really lock down a 25-minute starting role on any sort of team that's solid. Now, the Kings probably won't be solid next season, so maybe he can do that again next season. But yeah, there's a chance that they could grab someone like Zaire Smith who cuts into some of his playing time and does really limit what Jackson can do. If we have a look at his overall fantasy rank for the year, started off not great and then dropped significantly through the middle of the year. Started to recover, but it was the damage was done and he couldn't get himself inside the top 300 for the end of the season. We've got one more player to talk about in this little batch of players, and there is going to be very little to talk about Justin Patton of the Minnesota Timberwolves because he played a grand total of 3.7 minutes for the season. One game, 2 points, one steal. He started off the season with a foot injury. And you can say, like, oh, that's fine, he was injured. He wasn't injured during the season. He started off the season with a broken foot. He ended the season with a broken foot, though he was going to have surgery again. But in between, he played 38 games for Iowa in the G League. 38. Tom Thibodeau just refused to play him. refused, just would not play him at all. I am stunned that he actually got him in for 1 minute. Now, that to me is 100% negligent coaching. We've saw it, and I went on and on and on, and I'm sure you're sick about me saying it. There was 30-point blowouts, 20, maybe 30 is exaggerating, 20-point blowouts, 15-point margins with 2 minutes left, and he didn't come in the game. They just did not play him at all. They wouldn't make him active. It was absolute nonsense from Thibodeau. So we don't really have anything to go on with Justin Jackson's numbers. You can look at his ranking graph. So here you go. He played that one game. Cool. It tells us absolutely nothing because he just didn't see the court at all. Look, there's nothing to see here with any of these numbers for Justin Jackson. So let's look at what he did in the G League. In those 38 games, he started 28 and he played 23 minutes per game. He averaged almost 13 points and 5.4 rebounds in those 23 minutes, 1.6 assists, a steal, and 1.3 blocks. He took some threes. He hit 30% of his shots, hitting 0.4 triples per game, but at least he attempted some. Had a 48% field goal percentage and 76% from the line. There's something to work on there. A guy who's coming in as a big man with a true shooting of 53%. So obviously some work to do, but hitting his free throws, hitting some threes, some work to go there, but still a negative in the G League is never a good sign. He was a negative 5 net rating for the season, a PER of 17. Block rate was impressive, almost a 5% block rate, a 2.2% steal rate, a usage of 27% is obviously really high, but there's some things that he clearly needs to work on. Now, I don't think that he necessarily deserved huge minutes, and he definitely wasn't going to be playing minutes over Taj Gibson or Gorgie Jang or Karl Anthony Towns quite clearly, but I would have thought that we could get at least more than 3.7 minutes out of Justin Patton. Now, at the time, I didn't think the draft pick was a good one at all. It didn't make any sense, and I'll say this now, and I'll say it more when we go through the draft preview stuff. Unless you're an elite big man, unless you're DeAndre Ayton, who I'm probably not as high on as other people, Mo Bumba's in that category, Jaren Jackson Jr., who I am really interested in, those other big men outside that top four, top six type of range, most of the time, give me a wing. Now, there are times where you get some project type players that you can pick at the end of the first round, Rudy Gobert, Clint Capella, but often these guys who have been playing in the college system, who have put up some pretty dominant college statistics, and they go in that range, in that 12 to 24 range, they just struggle. We look at what Patton did in college. He averaged 13 points in 25 minutes. He averaged 6 rebounds, 1.4 blocks, 0.9 steals. But the big difference here is he shot 68% from the field and, weirdly enough, 52% from the line. So which one of those free throw percentages is real? A true shooting of 67% in his time in college. But one thing that did translate, the steal percentage about the same, the block percentage about the same. There is the rebound percentage fairly similar as well. So we got an idea from his G League numbers to his college numbers where he can contribute, but he's still obviously is going to need this opportunity. And I don't ever see him becoming a starter. And if he is a starter, I don't think he's ever a 30-minute per game starter. Unless for some reason he becomes a starter under Tom Thibodeau and he just consistently plays him 30-plus minutes, but that won't be the case. He was a decent scorer in college that didn't really translate fantastically to the G League. He still does have defensive things that he does need to work on. I don't know. It was a bad pick at the time. So were some of the other picks that came after it. I didn't like the selection at the time. It's turned out to be very much the case here, just given the fact that we just haven't seen him play at this point. But there is some defensive potential there. There is some shot blocking potential, which high shot blocking players can really elevate up in terms of fantasy rankings. So that's something we can have a look at or hope for. But there are plenty of players picked after him: the future MVP Kyle Kuzma, Joshie Hart, many others who have completely slipped my mind at this point. Some second round guys you would clearly have over Justin Patton at this point, the Jedi, OG Anunoby. There is many decisions that should have been made instead of Patton at this point from the Timberwolves. And Tibbs made the pick, and then just refuse to play him at all. And again, it's one of those things that just pisses me off to absolutely no end. You're seeing this guy have a completely wasted season and then ending it in surgery as well. Should have had the surgery earlier because it wasn't like he was going to play any sort of part in this team's season. If you have any disagreements with my take on Mitchell or Bam or the two Justins, Jackson and Patton, let me know. You can find me on Twitter at @RedRock_Beeble. And don't forget, if you are listening to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, give me a 5-star rating, leave a review. And you can also find us on Google Play, TuneIn, Stitcher, and of course on Spotify. And if you're watching this on YouTube and you're enjoying these graphs, go leave a like, hit subscribe, and leave a comment below. Guys, we are done here. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. See ya. Ike and Abogu.